We head overseas now on The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. We haven't talked a lot about the Islamic State lately on the show, but across northern Syria, 1,000 foreign fighters from nearly 50 countries are being held in a handful of wartime prisons, evidence of the ongoing fight against ISIS.
The big fear as ISIS collapses and the caliphate collapses is that all these people from all around the world who were zealots and ideologues and went to Syria to join this terrorist country, essentially, will slip back to their home countries and cause a tremendous security risk.
New York Times Washington correspondent Charlie Savage had the opportunity to tour two of the prisons alongside a congressional delegation. This tour was the first of its kind and gives a rare insight into places that detain captured ISIS fighters.
We're talking about prisons that are run by the Kurds, sometimes called the Syrian Democratic Forces, and those are the Americans' primary ally in Syria who are on the ground fighting the Islamic State as we provide air power. And so they've done a lot of heavy fighting for us, and as part of that, well, for themselves as well. And as part of that, they've been capturing Islamic State fighters as well as women and children who are associated with the so-called caliphate. And they put the women and children in internally displaced persons camps, kind of like refugee camps, and reporters can visit those. They have not been letting reporters come tour their prisons for the men, who they call foreign fighters. They have about 7 prisons for male fighters, and we looked at 2 of them. One of them is one of several school buildings that have been converted into makeshift prisons, and they've reinforced the doors of the classrooms and put bars on the windows with U.S. help in terms of funding for these improvements, added big concrete walls that are 2 stories tall surrounding it. And then the men are mostly in group cells. So there's 15, 20 guys inside each of these classrooms sort of lined up in a row, hundreds of them crammed into this school, and no one really knowing what's going to happen to them because their home countries are not taking them back, and the SDF is not a country, it's just an organization, a militia, and for now they're just warehousing them. The second place we went to is a real prison, a government prison that was built in the 1960s and then taken over by ISIS for a while and now taken over by the Kurds in a town called Hasaka. So this looks like a prison. It's got concrete walls and very narrow windows and much better security. It has a dark history, as you might imagine, being run by the Syrian regime and then ISIS. But they've painted it white, and they're trying to fix it up and make it a more humane place. It's also going to be mainly group cells, and when they are ready to open that next month, they think they can bring about 1,000 men there to consolidate their prisoners of war. But it still won't be enough. They don't have room for all the prisoners they're taking, and that's why they're desperate to get other countries to start taking their people back.
Now, were you able to speak to any of the prisoners or any of the guards?
No, well, I was not allowed to speak to prisoners at the one prison that was occupied, and that was in the town called Ain Issa. This was the schoolhouse prison we visited. I asked and it was denied. We did speak to people who were running the prisons, however. Both the future warden of the Hasaka prison that's getting ready to accept detainees and a SDF, Syrian Kurd, intelligence official who oversees 2 of the prisons, including that are currently occupied, including the one we walked through. And they described what they're doing, who they're holding there, what their approach is, the problems they're having, and generally tried to make a positive impression in terms of saying they were trying to respect human rights, not just because it's the right thing to do, but as a strategic matter, as a tactical matter, to try to deprogram and de-radicalize these detainees who are caught up in ISIS, but maybe at a low level.
Now, you went to these facilities with a congressional delegation. Could you tell us who went on the trip and also how much money and U.S. government resources are going towards supporting these prisons?
The delegation consisted of 2 lawmakers on the Senate Armed Services Committee, a Republican, Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, and a Democrat, Jeanne Shaheen of New Hampshire. And then on the trip, once we went in through Baghdad. We were joined by very senior military officials involved in the coalition that is fighting ISIS in Iraq and Syria, including General Paul Funk, who's the overall commander of the operations there. As far as what the United States is spending, I think relative to what we're spending on war in general, it seems to be a really relatively modest amount of money. What I was told was so far about $1.6 million from military funds has been gone to help the Kurds shore up security at these prisons. So they paid for hiring a contractor to come assemble this towering concrete perimeter wall around the Ainissa prison that we visited, for example. Last fall, there was a breakout there where some detainees got out through a hole, and this kind of security is intended to keep those on the inside in and those on the outside from breaking in. They're also adding security cameras and some interior gates in the hallways. But about $1 million, $1.5 million is what taxpayers in the United States are spending so far to try to help the Kurds keep these people from escaping.
You mentioned there are some countries that have dozens of citizens in these prisons and they don't want them to come back home. What makes more sense, keeping them there or trying to get them back to their home country so they can then be prosecuted?
It's a little bit unclear how many of these people can be prosecuted. And of course, each country has its own legal system and its own rules. And there's all kinds of complexities about whether they can prosecute someone who was not extradited from a foreign government, but just handed over by a non-state actor like the Kurds. And generally, I think the attitude seems to be, they left us, they went over there, we're going to wash our hands of them. We don't want the headache of having to deal with them and figure out a way to, you know, figure out who's dangerous and who's not and keep an eye on them. It just sounds like a giant problem. The downside, though, the risk to the world right now is that it's not at all clear that the Kurds, the SDF, has the capacity to hold on to these people forever. These prisons didn't seem to be as bad as one might have expected. Maybe with American help, they looked fairly secure. At some point, if the United States pulls out, as President Trump has been saying he sure would like to do, it doesn't seem likely that the Kurds will be able to hold on to their territory and the prisons within it forever. And at some point, they will either make a deal with Assad or they'll be rolled over or something. And then the question is, what will happen to all these presumably dangerous people? So that's part of the reason why counterterrorism experts, at least in the U.S. government, want each country to take responsibility for its nationals, for its citizens, and reduce that problem by sort of dividing it up and saying, bring them home, prosecute them if you can, or at least keep an eye on them, rather than having it sitting there as kind of a time bomb.
Charlie Savage is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and Washington correspondent for the New York Times and the author of Power Wars. Charlie, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
This is Ira Flatow, host of Science Friday. For over 30 years, the Science Friday team has been reporting high-quality science and technology news, making science fun for curious people by covering everything from the outer reaches of space to the rapidly changing world of AI, to the tiniest microbes in our bodies. Audiences trust our show because they know we're driven by a mission to inform and serve listeners first and foremost with important news they won't get anywhere else. And our sponsors benefit from that halo effect. For more information on becoming a sponsor, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.